mind swam with the letters he knew he must begin writing immediately, to men and women he preferred to correspond with only in writing. He feared he might be forced to request the physical presence of one or more of them. John greatly disliked sharing his laboratories. Actually, he greatly disliked sharing any portion of his private castle. Several years before, the king had allotted him funds to construct a small manor just a mile from the walls of the compound, and John had named his new home Urania. He had installed every instrument of astronomical observation that he had so far collected. They were bolted tightly into his courtyard's ground and protected by metal domes that closed out the salt and the water. John was fiercely protective of them, as he had, after all, spent his life acquiring these marvels. He was not often moved to share them with magicians he considered lesser than himself, that is, with anyone else. The very notion of a swarm of interested parties converging upon his lovely, peaceful, near-complete castle caused his breath to race, so that he began to feel like his heart was flapping open and closed like a door in the wind. He found himself hating this bright streak in the sky. He had secured from King Michael 4 armed men to guard his manor, 1 for each gate, and outfitted them with swords blessed by the Hierophant and forged from the metal of fallen satellites. His instruments were priceless. He would not leave anything to chance. And yet King Michael had insisted the manor be built with extra bedrooms to house other magicians he invited to the Cape from time to time. John could hardly object. It was not his money used to build Urania. But during the days and weeks these other orbital doctors used his equipment, he lingered behind them as they worked. He knitted his fingers together, watching to be sure they did not smudge their face greases on glass casings or jostle any of his precisely aligned water tables or scrying bowls. And yet now John must write to the other orbital doctors. Who? All of them. In their own subpar astronomical spaces where they calculated with half, no, a fourth of his natural alacrity. And he must ask them if anywhere in any of their own records and charts was this thing, this glowing streak, this cosmological rumination he himself had missed. It was all too much for him to bear. John's already pounding heart sputtered. He could not catch his breath. He bent to his knees, staring up at the mysterious light in the late afternoon sky, bright and beautiful. Mizar rushed to his side, patted his arm. "Sir, are you all right?" Then he fell backward. Mizar immediately clutched his wrist in a vain effort to find his pulse, for John had been somewhat prone to fainting in his youth. So Mizar was pressing up and down his arm as though testing fruit, and then a great woolly heat descended over the top of John's head. He could remember nothing, and then he passed from the realm of the physical and also from the constraints of his worry and into a gauze-like swoon. Chapter 5. The Pardoness. Marvel Parsons had hardly emerged from the shadow of Canaveral Tower when a feeling of profound dread swept over him, and he turned and looked up. Beside him, Juniper did the same. In the white incandescence of the late fall sky, Marvel saw the light. Juniper said, "Oh, well, shit." The young guard squinted and cupped his hands around his eyes for a moment until he shook his head and murmured, "God, that hurts my eyes. The sky's so bright." A very light wind swept over them. The rain had completely stopped. Other people in the courtyard, now hushed, had likewise turned their faces to the sky, their wares forgotten. They all stood like silent statues. "Oh, shit," Juniper said again. "What is that?" Marvel found that he was comforted by the younger man's demeanor. "I have no idea. A comet is what it looks like." He turned to Juniper. "We'll go now to the Pardoness. You come with me." "What? But the light?" "Yes, it's probably a comet, as I said." "What will the Pardoness do?" "She'll do what she does," Marvel replied with straining patience. pardon us for crimes we will soon commit." When he saw the confusion on Juniper's face, he said, "You are a spy, aren't you? I'm taking you to an important place. Perhaps the most important one we have here at the Cape. There you can spy all you please. Afterward, I will need you to be of some assistance to me. Is that an acceptable deal?" Juniper blinked. "I will pay you. Whatever they're paying you, I'll pay you more. Double. Triple." He shrugged at last. "If you say so." Then his handsome face cracked open. "I'm not a spy, though." He would act, and later he would consider his actions. It had been so for him during all the important moments in his life. This quality, he supposed, made him a good leader. It was politically expedient, at any rate. It gave him an air of authority. Marvel had never actually been to Green Butterfly's chamber, though he had committed many sins. The zealousness of his youth and the trust he'd placed in his own judgment meant that he'd done little over the course of his lifetime for which he believed he needed forgiveness. Surely not the poisoning of the Mystagogue all those years ago. An unpleasant means to a holier end. In that matter, Marvel wanted to believe the balance of righteousness still tipped in his favor. And yet that light. The light in the sky had rattled Marvel in a way that even the prisoner with no ears had not, or discovering a spy like Juniper, from outside the compound, slinking about in a poor costume. Both of those things were concerning, to be sure. But that light? The light was worse. It could be only one of two things. The space shuttles returning, or some heavenly body hurtling perilously toward them. Marvel had never truly realized how high Canaveral Tower was until he and Juniper had made it halfway up. The white metal stairs went on forever. After a few minutes, he felt the muscles in the tops of his thighs burning. Juniper, ahead of him, and apparently still amiable, remained unwinded. To be young again, Marvel thought. But then he looked at Juniper's shoulders tilting right, then left as he climbed, and so forth inside their dust-colored fabric casings, and noticed the elbows of the jacket were patched with leather. The entire garment didn't fit him right. He was obviously not the first owner. They climbed in tighter spirals until the staircase crested abruptly at a large, solid metal door. There was no landing. Just a massive door in the wall with a ring knocker in the center. Juniper looked over his shoulder at Marvel. "What?" Marvel said. "Go in. I'm the Hierophant. I don't need permission." Juniper nodded. "But shouldn't I knock?" "Oh, probably." Marvel put his hand to his temple. He knocked. Nothing happened. He knocked again. Then the door opened into a circular room as wide as the tower itself, filled with uncomfortably warm, thin smoke that tumbled out onto the stairs and into their faces. Marvel and Juniper coughed as they entered. The only movement of air inside the room was provided by a single attendant, who presumably had also opened the door. She was nude. To Marvel's great interest, as he had always maintained a high degree of appreciation for naked bodies, male or female. Her peanut-shaped body swayed. Her nipples, flat and oval like galaxies, were the only thing Marvel could look at, until he forced himself to look away. She walked quickly back over to the Pardoness, and began fanning her with a sheet of paper-like metal. What in the world were they burning? He glanced at Juniper. Juniper was staring at the attendant. Her skin looked wet enough to pull from her bones in strips. She was so sweaty. Why were they up here sweltering? The Pardoness herself reclined on a couch, almost invisible under a web of diaphanous fabric. She peered at them serenely and touched her attendant softly on the thigh. The woman stopped fanning. Marvel and Juniper stepped farther into the stuffy room and struggled not to cough. For furniture, the room contained only a few tables, a couch, and an amply sized bed at the back end of the chamber. Now, I know who you are, said the pardoness. Her voice was melodious, but strangely accented, as though she had never spoken to anybody and had learned to pronounce all her words from books. He'd assumed she would be older than himself, since she had been the pardoness before he had even come to the Cape. But her age was hard to tell. Her gaunt face was all but hidden under the hood she wore, pulled over her ears and hair. The skin around her eyes seemed sweaty and moist, hardly surprising, given how warm it was. Though the rest of her body was covered by beautiful fabrics, Marvel could make out the vague shape of her arms, thin, spindly. But her lower half was difficult to see. Only the tips of her two swollen feet protruded. Marvel took a slight bow and nodded. Likewise, you need no introduction. Then he looked at the attendant as though she might yet introduce her mistress, but she did nothing.
I must say, I am surprised to see you here, High Priest. You must have committed a grievous act indeed.
Why, in the name of all that is holy, do you have this smoke up here?
He waved his hand.
For my health.
That's insane.
It's not for you to judge what is insane, priest. Not in this chamber. This room is my own kingdom.
This was true. The title of pardoness was a hereditary one, and had been passed down from mother to daughter for centuries, endowing its bearer with complete autonomy. It was said, and most fervently believed throughout the land, that she was a direct descendant of the ancient King Armstrong, who had once walked on the moon. Privately, Marvel thought that after so many generations, it was impossible to know where the Pardoness's family had come from, just as his own family's origins were a mystery. But her title held meaning beyond that. Marvel did believe that men had once walked on the moon, and if she was their descendant, then she must possess certain powers. Of that there was no question.
Yes, he murmured. I meant no disrespect. I think you did, she replied mildly. But it doesn't matter to me. Why are you here? We are protective of our solitude, aren't we, Discovery?
Very.
The attendant walked to a side table and lit a candle. A sweet smell filled the chamber, and Marvel wondered if the smoke was some kind of mild narcotic. The door clanged heavily as it finally shut, drawn closed by its own weight, leaving the chamber in near darkness. The smoking candle made useless light. A few clusters of tallow candles flickered in the corners of the room, as was the custom for royal chambers, set before mirrors to amplify their light. Marvel swept aside his cassock and went into the room, as though it were his own.
Bring me a chair, girl.
Can you not see there are no chairs? Asked the pardoness.
Ah.
Marvel felt the ends of his mouth tug upward into a smirk.
You're used to getting your way. I do empathize. But you will be disappointed here.
She raised an eyebrow.
Shall we come to the point of your visit? Discovery and I are accustomed to spending our afternoons in relaxation and care of ourselves. Mornings are our work time, and this morning is quickly running out. In my older age, I am also somewhat protective of my health. Come to your meaning, please.
He wrinkled his nose. Sitting in an overheated cloud of smoke is good for your health.
Come to your business.
Marvel tried to make out her body beneath the piles of shimmering fabric. He could see nothing beyond her emaciated arms, wrapped like tent poles in carrying bags. The pardoness took a swallow of a dark liquid beside her bed and placed the glass back on the table with a trembling hand, as though lifting it had been all she could manage. As he looked more closely at the protrusion of sweaty cheekbones beneath her large, dark eyes, it dawned on him that she might be starving to death,
although he well knew from the account books the amount of food sent up to her chamber each week. Her fingernails were painted red. She might have been 60, but she might have been 40 and just ill. He saw no malformations to speak of. There was something wrong, though, just out of sight. He could sense it, and was unsettled. She reminded him of an infant chick that could not quite hatch, that would shortly dry out in its enervated egg and die. He took a breath.
I am here to ask your pardon, your highest pardon. I ask you to forgive my future actions.
What are they?
They will most likely be awful.
I cannot forgive what hasn't happened yet.
You must, she shrugged.
I don't have to do anything.
He sighed.
They will be treasonous. The highest treason. I plan to disappear, to leave King Michael's service. Can you forgive me now?
He had not meant to reveal it. He was appalled that he had, but saying it relieved him. Beside him, Juniper tried hard not to react, though Marvel could feel the ripple of surprise pass through him. So Juniper had not known. At least he hadn't known Marvel was planning to leave. What had he come for, then?
Marvel stared at the pardoness, and she looked back without pity.
After you have committed these actions, come tell me again, and I will or will not forgive you. I believe now we are finished.
Her eyes strayed to the door. He shook his head. He had marched up this tower without a thought. That was his way when he decided on something. He wanted, needed to leave the Cape. He would return to the darkness of Kansas with a clear conscience, and there he was certain he would find the Mystagog alive, and he would kill him. He wanted forgiveness for murder. He had always been a zealous man in whatever he did, even to the point of martyrdom. He needed to be sure he had the heaven's favor. The pardoness was held by every denomination still extant, every carnival on the land, and every sect that worshipped the shuttles, to be an infallible oracle of forgiveness. She was the only connection anyone on earth had to the heavens.
Have you seen the light in the sky?
Marvel asked. The room had no windows.
I have not, but I have been told of it by my dear Discovery.
He wondered if they were lovers.
What do you think it is?
It could be many things.
He sighed again.
When I was a boy living far away, I had a vision. Maybe not unlike the visions you have as an oracle.
Forgiveness requires no fortune-telling.
Well, he grew restless. I had a vision. Just one. I saw that the true king, the king who will sit on the throne when the shuttles return, the king whose ascendance would create the conditions for their return, if you will, would appear here, the Cape. So I did what I had to do to come here.
We all have megalomaniacal fantasies. It's quite normal.
The pardoness lifted her chin, so her eyes were even more deeply in shadow, and she tilted her face toward Juniper, who went reddish with embarrassment.
Less normal to act on them. But you seem to have fared well.
Marvel narrowed his eyes and began to dig at his thumb again. It was a habit that undercut his authority, and yet he had never been able to break it for more than a few months at a time.
I killed a man so I could come here all those years ago. As you may know, I began my service here at the Cape as a lowly priest, and rose on my own talents to the position I hold now.
Impressive.
You don't seem impressed.
He cringed and sighed at his own petulance. She laughed.
Not terribly. I'm sorry. Many men, in many guises, have lived this story. And none are more special than you. Or less special.
She gestured to her handmaid, Discovery.
When you hear as many tales as we do, they begin to seem similar, which is for the best.
We must cultivate perfect indifference in order to forgive wholly.
Do you understand what I'm telling you?
That smoke she inhaled constantly, surely that affected her judgment.
My vision of the true king, reigning at the Cape, was so strong that I killed a man.
A very, very important man. I was young then, just a boy, and I put poison in his cup, and he drank it, and he convulsed, and he died right before my eyes, and all I could think was, I am free now.
I felt no sorrow, no pain. I left that very evening, and crossed the deathscapes to this selfsame palace compound, set myself up as a young apprentice priest, and I rose to power.
The acme of power.
He spat his words out like food that repulsed him.
Ah, said the Pardoness, and shifted on her couch. Something bulbous under all that fabric. A part of her body?
He saw it, just for an instant.
You feel moved to tell me your story.
I am moved to listen. She glanced at Discovery, who smiled.
Are you moved?
The handmaid nodded.
I'm not trying to move you, Marvel growled. The man I thought I killed. I have reason to believe he isn't dead.
How unfortunate.
But why haven't you asked for a pardon for that killing? Or intended killing, as it seems?
Because it was justified.
How so?
Marvel grimaced.
I thought he deserved to die because he didn't recognize the truth of my vision. And other reasons. Back then, I was certain my vision was from the heavens, and that he was stymieing me wrongfully.
Marvel held his breath for a time.
But not just for those reasons.
He deserved to die for
other reasons. He himself has killed many.
The Pardoness was now nodding, the iridescent fabric sliding back and forth over her shoulders.
But now you think your vision was merely the fantasy of a fervently religious boy.
Marvel swallowed.
In a sense. And?
Well, Marvel took a breath.
I have come to suspect that this same man, this very important man, is still alive. That I didn't kill him after all.
Praise the shuttles, replied the Pardoness. You must be grateful.
You don't understand, because I must kill him this time. He will never allow me to return to my homeland. He would never accept me back.
Marvel did not say that he still harbored a cold fury toward the Mystagogue, that it had not dimmed after these many years.
Why go back at all?
Why not stay here, where you have ruled mostly wisely and mostly justly? Her eyes sparkled.
Where you are mostly respected, instead of reviled.
Marvel's destiny, his only purpose, was to serve the true king, whoever he turned out to be. He had been sure of this since his earliest cognizance. This true king would appear in Kansas. It had been so all along. Kansas was where the disease ruined the world, and Kansas was where salvation would spring forth. He tried to catch the Pardoness's eyes in a meaningful way, but they were shadowed by her veil and hard to see. Her lower face, cut deep with two smile lines, pulled into a frown or a smile. He couldn't tell. The truth was that Marvel was not sure if it was right to kill the Mystagogue, but he knew it was necessary. In order for Marvel to end his days peacefully in Kansas, the tyrant must die.
Because I know now the true king is not here at the Cape. My vision was wrong.
You sound sure of yourself.
But what of this new light in the sky? Could it not be the shuttles returning?
It could be many things.
He said her own words back to her with a smile. This time she smiled back.
and you are a man very convinced of the rightness of your faith, even when your convictions shift with the wind. Perhaps especially then.
Marvel ground his molars together. He had the intrusive thought that he was merely acting out of self-interest, that he'd grown tired of responsibility and the decadence of the courtiers. He had grown tired of his own daughter, perhaps so tired that he would never be satisfied until he left this place for the solitude of Hulda's black watchtower, for the burnished memory of his pious youth. Maybe he remembered the black watchtower as a place it had never been. It was a distasteful notion, that his deep righteousness could be nothing more than nostalgia.
"You are not easy to talk to," was all he said. "I thought I was supposed to confess my sins here."
The Pardoness continued to gaze at him.
"You are having many thoughts.
Let me share one of my own." She motioned to her hidden lower half without removing the coverlet.
"I am a woman in pain. Over the years, it has become unbearable. My misfortune was to be born to a very unmixed line, one which maximized the purity of my blood at the expense of my worldly body."
His eyes followed her gesture. Juniper leaned forward as though he could see through the blankets.
"Well, what's wrong with you?" Marvel asked. "I have tried many remedies, but due to the deformities, I cannot bear children. There was never any hope for it, so I never missed it, and that time has passed at any rate. But this means my only heir will be Discovery, and she is not of the correct lineage. She will never be accepted as a new Pardoness."
"I'm sorry," he said.
"Don't be. All things must end. But I ask you this. If my line, for centuries unbroken, will now be snuffed out with no legitimate heir, couldn't it be that this is truly the return? That the true king will, or has already, appeared?"
A buzzing anger rose in Marvel's throat.
"Yes, of course that could be," he thought, "and yet I still don't believe it."
"Anything is possible. But you have no idea where he might be." The Pardoness folded her shockingly thin hands on her lap.
"This is as good a place as any," she murmured.
"What is your ailment?"
"It has no name in the medical books. Surely it is the result of inbreeding."
She moved aside one of the blankets momentarily. Discovery dropped her fan and rushed to the Pardoness's side.
"Grace, don't!"
She clapped her hand over her mouth, as though the exposure of her mistress would cause her physical pain. But the Pardoness pulled off a portion of the coverlet to reveal the most hideous mass of tissue Marvel had ever beheld. Her legs, both as grotesquely swollen as skin bags filled with water, were 6 or 7 times the size of a normal limb. The skin was dry, discolored in spots, pink toward the knee but blue and even purple by the toes. It looked dead or dying. The feet as large and bulbous as square stones. How could a person live this way? Surely she couldn't walk. The agony must have been unimaginable. His mouth fell agape until he was able to close it, which he did quickly, but not before she had seen the horror and confusion on his face. The Pardoness remained sanguine as she recovered her legs. But in Marvel's mind's eye, there were only those appendages, lumpy trees of burst capillaries and flaking skin. Every nutrient her body extracted from food must go to feed those bloated overgrowths. That was why her upper body appeared so fragile.
"My God," she nodded. "My given name, Hierophant, is Green Butterfly. I'm sure you knew this."
He nodded.
"Like my namesake. I long to be free. I long to fly away from this tower. Perhaps as you yourself do."
He stopped nodding.
"These legs are rotten.
They will be the death of me. And yet, I'm not ready to die.
He said nothing.
I would like to be rid of this prison.
She motioned to her lower half.
Just as you would.
How? She rearranged her sumptuous fabrics around herself weakly. Discovery bent over her and fluffed them up, then went to the sideboard and lit another smoking candle, and yet more sweet-smelling medicine filled the air.
That is a question I have long pondered. I have considered many different approaches, but now I have the ear of the second most powerful man in the land. How might I be free, priest?
I will not give the cape another pardoness.
This light in the sky may portend death for us all, or eternal life. These are the times we are living in. Somehow I knew I would live to see them.
Then she said,
I will forgive your past sin of attempting to kill this man. I will do this if you free me.
I can't just take you out of the tower. Everyone would see.
No.
Free me. She pointed to her legs. Now that he knew what was beneath the fabric, he could not unsee it. They were like sausages bursting their casings, and Marvel had watched many a person be tortured. That little man. The walking doctor. Came Juniper's voice in his ear. The one with no ears. From Kansas. No, said Marvel to no one. The word floating up as from the bottom of a well. He said his patients always lived, I thought. Are you suggesting he take her legs off? He shook his head. You're crazy. The blood alone.
Juniper's clear eyes seemed strangely delighted.
And anyway, Marvel said disturbed, with all respect due to your office, Pardoness, I'm not asking forgiveness for my past sins. I want forgiveness for my future sin. And if the sin was once justified, why shouldn't it be justified again?
I cannot give you that. But if, as you say, this sin is justified, you don't need my or anyone's forgiveness.
He tossed his hands up. Why did I even come to you?
Because you are uncertain. You,
she spoke in a solemn voice,
are a man of uncertain faith. And yet you are also a man who deeply needs to believe you are right. Your longing for peace surprises you. Am I correct?
She reached for her little glass again and took a drink.
My predicament, though less philosophical, is similar. I wish to be free of this bondage. The end will come, either now or later, but I wish to use my remaining days as I desire. I wish to leave this place.
There had been a few rare moments during his life when Marvel felt he truly understood other human beings. The isolation of his rank and temperament lifted, almost like a mist dissolving, and what remained was his hand in that of another human. Courageous, contented, unified. He glanced about, absorbing all he saw in this dreadful room, so unlike his own chamber. The medicinal smoke, the sallow, nude, sycophantic attendant, the grim deformities, and indeed he judged this woman's life to be a prison, and here he had thought she lived in luxury. Everyone did. What did this unsavory truth now require of him, as a man of religion? He could not help her. She gestured to the sky beyond the ceiling.
The world may change forever. This may be the return. We may soon be transported upward to heaven. Or we may live in a new way here on earth. No one knows. Not even me.
I don't think anything is going to happen, Marvel said.
That is your prerogative.
And you say I definitely don't need a pardon.
Not if you believe what you are doing is right.
But I don't know.
Then no one does.
Marvel had spoken before he even realized it. Bring the prisoner Tycho here. He will save her if he can. He paused when Juniper nodded eagerly. It's the least we can do, Marvel muttered.
Juniper left and returned some minutes later with the news that Tygo was already out of his cell on the order of the chief orbital doctor, John Sousa, an ineffectual pipsqueak of a man Marvel had distrusted for years. And yet for the moment he felt untroubled by the hitch in his plans. The order had been issued. Tygo would see the Pardoness soon enough. He would look at her legs. He would do something to free this woman if he could. Thus Marvel would use this good deed to set in motion a string of treacheries he hoped were for the common good. Just as when he'd left Kansas the first time. This circle pleased him, although he could not quite put his finger on why. He bowed deeply to the Pardoness and turned to leave.
Grace, I have done what I can.
She nodded, and he strode toward the door, but she said something from behind him that he did not hear. He looked back.
What was that?
I said that faith is both reasonless and the reason for everything. Beware any certainty, High Priest, for not many things are certain, and the ones that are certainly have no reason to be. Chapter 6 The Angels. John Sousa, King Michael's chief orbital doctor, knew at once when he awoke that the comet he had seen meant nothing and everything. Likewise, he knew he was not sick, but also that he was very unwell. And outside, the daylight was escaping, and beside his window there chirped a brush fire of birds. So loud, he wondered at their purpose. What could they be saying to each other, over and over in such screams? He knew by the organ-colored sky that it was late afternoon, for no one had seen fit to draw the curtains. He was naked. He had soaked his bed through with sweat, and he knew also that he had now wasted some unwastable amount of time with his wretched bedriddenness. And so he staggered to the window and threw it open, causing the birds outside to blow a fresh wave of sound at him before they ascended and reconvened on the east gate. He stared at the white comet. It was so plain in its there-ness. He folded his elbows on the window ledge and squinted. John was so tired. So very tired of his life, and everything he had ever done, and every thought he had ever thought, and now, even now, when faced with this bright and indisputably heavenly artifact, he could not muster a single interesting thought. He could think only of how much he did not wish to think about it.
"No, he is awake, look!"
came Mizar's voice from behind him, and also the clamorous, unfamiliar footfalls of a group. John turned. In the doorway stood Mizar with one of the king's elite guards, with his lion-shaped face mask pulled down, always a terrifying sight, for the masks the guards wore made them look like deranged partygoers. Beside the two men, or rather with them, was a slight, dark-haired man in the last gasp of his youth, chained around the ankles and staring at the entire scene with an expression of grateful hunger, the way John might have looked at his instruments after he'd been a long time away. Mizar pushed aside the guard and rushed to John, taking him immediately to the bedside and sitting him down again, and then easing him into a cotton robe.
"Are you all right, sir? You are always so moved by everything. I tell you it's a curse as often as a blessing."
Mizar looked pointedly at the prisoner in chains, whose every piece of clothing was brilliant blue, or at least had once been so. The prisoner and his garments were presently covered in dirt, and what might have been, blood. John, even in his wretched state, was sure he had never seen this person before. The prisoner met his eyes without smiling or nodding. John pushed Mizar back and pointed,
"Who is this?"
Mizar motioned to the guard to unchain the man's arms, and then to wait beyond the bedchamber. But he flicked his wrist to indicate the guard should remain vigilant to sounds of discord within. Then the prisoner came into the center of the room, like an orbital doctor called to give a lecture. Mizar cleared his throat and said,
"This, sir, is a walking doctor, a champion of..."
He cast his eyes this way and that and lowered his voice.
"Well,
of surgery.
John blankly stared. And?
He is a prisoner, sir. Really more than a prisoner. He is set to be executed in not many days for his treasonous use of living bodies. But that is not relevant to your cause.
John could not make sense of any of this.
And? Sir, you said to me, who? And well, this is the who.
Mizar beamed, and the wrinkles around his eyes bunched. He was strutting about the room in his hennish way, clacking his shoes on the tile. John felt with a lurch the very familiarity of this man, with whom he had forcibly belonged for the majority of his natural life. He understood their unwieldy togetherness as a kind of punishment for his being born in this particular place at this particular time, at an astrological confluence of moments. Here, at the Cape, at this time, the eon of pain, the ache of the world. Mizar was John's punishment for being the final preposterous product of his rich parents' miserable and ambitious begetting. John had been born a seventh son, a lumpy white potato with no heartbeat, but he'd lived despite his nursemaid's dire predictions. And when it became apparent that he would not expire naturally, they'd squashed him in celebration beneath heavy pearlized fabrics and earrings made from moon rocks. But still he lived on, despite these indignities. Small, delicate, and defiant. In this meek way, John had discovered himself strangely invulnerable. Sick, but never dying throughout his whole endless childhood, until his parents died themselves, together, poisoned with 15 of their own banquet guests, in a stupendous and oft-spoken-of feat of intrigue. At that time, John had been only 8. Since then, Mizar had been his sole caretaker. In John's worst moments, he felt himself incapable of any lasting devotion to another human being. If he could not love Mizar, who had fed and educated him, whom could he love? And now Mizar was an old man, one who soon would be in need of care himself. His face was a place where many things had happened, and John suspected his mind was similarly beginning to deteriorate. He watched with some cloudy dissatisfaction as Mizar stood in the center of the room, still talking, gesturing up and down at the blue-clad prisoner.
This prisoner predicted the heavenly manifestation. He is the who, Mizar was saying.
He nudged the small man forward. The prisoner recoiled at the touch. John took a breath.
What did you say?
Mizar nodded once.
Yes, it's true. This man, a self-taught surgeon and an accused traitor, was discovered by his jailer to have fainted dead away, just like yourself, sir, when he observed the comet in the sky this late afternoon. When he was revived, he was heard to exclaim that his...
And here Mizar removed a slip of paper from his pocket and read from it an exact quote.
That his prediction had come to pass, and that this omen should not be ignored by the faithful, or by any one of us alive in these times, as it signifies a shift in our cosmic destiny.
John touched his temple. Mizar's habit of writing every infernal thing down so he would not forget it was a great source of irritation, and yet daily it did prove to be useful. He narrowed his eyes at the prisoner, who was rather strikingly small, and who stood morosely with his black hair greased to his head in ugly whirls, and who had at some very absurd previous moment in his life decided to have a cluster of stars tattooed on the side of his face, and who, even now, was making every attempt to hide this act of youthful abandon by affixing a swatch of hair over the area. He might have been 30 or 32, and his blue overcoat and pants were fashioned from heavy plush cloth, no doubt very expensive. But now, after days or months in the palace jail, they were torn, and he looked quite like a penurious seizure of a person, the sort of man John might turn his eyes from if he were to spot him on the short ride from his own Urania castle to the king's palace compound, which was in fact the only time John went outside his own gates at all, ever. Although chained at the feet, this small prisoner did command something. If not an air of authority, he had at least some magnifying presence, which made him seem, in his current state, cruelly afflicted by their skepticism. He gazed at John eagerly. John coughed.
Well, exactly how did you predict this happening? What's your name and where are you from?
When the prisoner spoke, it was as though he were continuing outward from the center of some already formed thought. His voice was nasal, and all his words hit at the same pitch.
This whole world is filled with time, it seems like, but when time actually came to me, I wasted it.
He shrugged glumly.
I'm half convinced at this point that it's because I was drinking too much back then. But you would have too if you were me. So anyhow, at my last, what do I call it? Appointment? If you could even call such a shit pile of a job an appointment. And I think that's roundly debatable. I had extra time at that job. Lots. And I wasn't filling it the way I should have been.
He paused.
So yes, I admit that I was drinking. I told you that up front. Remember that. And so one night I passed out and had the most amazing dream. You know how hard it is to explain dreams, so I won't even try. But when I woke up, I went to my mirror and looked at it. I was going to shave.
Here he reached up and felt his sparsely grizzled face rather thoughtfully.
Not that I probably needed to, so that adds a whole other layer to the mystery. I mean, it does if you know me.
John glared.
The prisoner hurried up. And a trance came over me while I was shaving, and when I came back to myself, I had written all kinds of things, by which I mean the most beautiful, predictive things.
John continued to glare.
And that is what really happened, I swear. I could show you, but these dickheads...
The prisoner gestured to the guards at the door, but surely meant every person at the Cape generally.
Took everything from me when they threw me in prison, and said they destroyed it. But I'm sure that's a lie. Because why would they destroy evidence? They'll need it later if they want any semblance of justice. How else would they prove their charges at my execution? But what am I saying? You're all liars. I know you are. You don't need to prove anything.
He cast his glance at John and Mizar angrily.
If any of the things they took from me still exist somewhere, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
You have something written down somewhere. Some proof. Is that what this rant is supposed to be communicating? John rubbed at his forehead.
I did. I do. Somewhere. They gave me charts and figures and etc.
Who gave you charts? The prisoner stared dumbly.
The angels. I thought I told you. Weren't you listening?
Angels? The prisoner nodded, unfazed.
I dreamed about angels. I woke up in a trance and wrote it all down. That's the whole story.
John's airway compressed, as happened when he became nervous.
Please, slow down. A moment ago you mentioned a mirror. A scrying mirror? Are those not prohibitively expensive while also being tremendously illegal for anyone but the Hierophant and his orbital doctors?
John's own favorite scrying mirror was a relic, a piece of black granite from the other end of Merid Island, where nearly 1,000 years before men had fashioned a stone mirror that faced the sky, bearing the names of all who had died in spaceflight. It was presumed to be a religious monument, but who really knew the motivations of the ancients? The sky mirror had broken over the centuries, but nevertheless, it seemed concrete proof that men really had traveled outside the world. Once. When John was not even 17 years old, a mere boy, still a student at the Palace Conservatory for Astronomics, it dawned upon him that this relic might be where an attuned soul such as himself would be most likely to receive a revelation. So he'd stolen a shard from the ruins of this mirror. In fact, it was Mizar who'd driven him in a horse cart to a dock on the far side of Merid Island, and bribed a skittish fisherman to row the young John Sousa through the festering rot that was the inner marsh, to wait while he chipped off a portion of the mirror large enough to be of use. The swamp was dangerous and malarial, alligator and snake-ridden, and Mizar had given the fisherman a great deal of money to perform the feat and keep quiet about it. Since then, John had been gazing every so often into his chip of stolen black mirror, looking for...
what, and why. It was a mystery to him yet. He felt uneasy about it sometimes. There seemed a unique perversity in viewing vertical destiny on a chip of horizontalia, and this paradox had in recent years begun to seem irreconcilable. He could not reason his way around it, and John's scrying had lately, inevitably, come to nothing. When an irrefutable sign did come, a comet, no less, it showed itself to him in his servant's fish pond, not upon an ancient monument, not even a holy water table. Such an irony was, in John's opinion, so predictable that it was hardly an irony at all. The small blue-dressed prisoner was shrugging now, his shoulders swimming in the coat like two nubby goldfish blindly hitting the sides of a bowl. Yes, illegal and stupid on top of it. I loathe divination. Let me tell you, the idea is so boring to me. That we pick something, anything, at random and ascribe an equally random meaning to it is pure lunacy. He paused and seemed to wait for John to curse at him, but it did not happen. So he spoke again, this time with more warmth. Listen, I am a surgical doctor, and I deal inside bodies. What can I say? If that makes me a traitor to you religious people, then I'm a traitor, and you'll execute me for it. But my point is this. I deal in the physical. I don't abide your star worship. I don't do magic. I wouldn't even know what it means to see an omen or predict a happening. To my mind, that's impossible. He paused again. So I can't make you believe me because I can hardly believe myself.
John nodded shallowly.
Listen, said the prisoner, apparently sensing the shift in John's mood. I saw this comet in a dream, and even though I don't believe in your stupid rockets, I am here telling you that I predicted it, and it happened, and something changed, and inside me now there's an outpouring of something, of knowledge, maybe, but it's being choked to death by everyone's disbelief, including my own. So there it is. I don't even believe myself. Are you happy?
He was vibrating with what appeared to be rage, and thrust his mottled hands at his face to rearrange his hair again over the tattoos. John noticed, for the first time, to his amazement, that the prisoner had no ears.
What happened to you there? He pointed to the holes.
The man had surely known from the instant his ears had taken leave of his body that he would ever afterward be explaining their absence, thought John, and indeed he began nodding in earnest.
Yes, that, he said rather sadly. That was obviously a punishment.
But why? He bridled.
Look it up. I'm sure somewhere in this disgusting place some record-keeping piece of goat shit has written down every single one of my offenses in hideous detail on my execution warrant. The ears, sir, happened many years ago, when I was in Dread, Kansas, and I surely deserved it at the time. But these days I wonder if the punishment outweighed the crime, because now that I'm a visionary, I'm thinking very different things about that period in my, life. Let's call it a life. Yes.
He smiled again, this time without pity.
Kansas is a place of hell.
John was fading. Endless talk. It seemed his life was nothing but endless listening and talking. The bed and the room beyond it formed vast empty spaces, and he wanted to be alone in them to gather his wits. But something about the prisoner interested him. There was a yearning in him that went beyond this undignified attempt to save his own life. John was not blind or stupid, but he was an insatiably curious man, which was, he supposed, its own exquisite kind of stupidity. He folded his hands in his lap as he sat still on the bed. The man was probably lying about the comet. It didn't matter. And he was dressed in clothes far too fine for a walking doctor, even a very successful one. Yet that didn't matter either. His transparent motive remained, absent of any discernible use, to John. If he had come to deceive, he was not very good at it, and he did not seem the sort of man likely to subject himself to anything he was not good at, even to save his life. So it followed that he must have come for some other reason. The prisoner took a hobbled step toward John,
You must forgive me, he said. They will execute me here, certainly sooner rather than later. The Hierophant himself has already interviewed me once. I know I don't deserve to die.
My job is not to pardon prisoners.
But I did foresee this calamity, and other things, and I know I could foresee more, with the right equipment and the right minds helping me interpret my visions. The fact of the matter is simple. I'm not educated in astrologics. Myself, I know the human corpus, I know medicines and surgeries, and have been practicing them since I was a child at my mother's side. I don't know the skies, and I understand even less about the voices I heard in my head.
John said nothing.
It's been said, out in the country, I mean, not here, that you aren't like other Cape men. That the head-cutting and the bloodletting and wonder-blood are just a means to an end anyway, for everyone. But you're much more interested in the end. That's the rumor about you.
John raised his eyebrows, and Mizar shrugged. Who knew what people said? It wasn't any of John's concern, though he did not put much effort into fitting into Cape society. It was quite possible the man wasn't just trying to flatter him. The prisoner went on.
When this light struck by outside my window today, I knew I was still alive for this reason. To tell you, specifically you, Lord John Sousa, what I saw in my vision. I truly believe I'm alive right now to bear witness to my prediction coming true.
He opened and closed his fists thoughtfully.
These words congealed around John, and he quivered fruitishly inside them.
Talking. Talking.
But outside, still that comet entirely there, entirely not going away.
And here before him, a man who might,
yes, terror, might,
be able, or at least who might believe himself able, to explain this marvel. It was that belief, which seemed itself marvelous and humble in spite of everything, that moved John so awfully,
so that his heart skipped again, this time down into his feet where it remained, and he had to gasp for a new breath.
Oh, his body, so frail a thing when pitted against the tireless lashings of his mind.
He clutched the bedpost and leaned forward as if to vomit.
Yes, yes, John replied. Perhaps it does mean something.
Nameless sir, we who love the truth are bound to be undone by it, as it seems always to be melting just as we grab for it.
You are telling me you think you can see more and better things than I can in my own scrying mirror? Is that what I hear you saying?
It was just one time. I was in a trance, but...
Yes, I do.
Where did you get your mirror?
The prisoner glanced over his shoulder.
A simple, very legal, shaving mirror.
John waved his hand.
I know you're lying about predicting the comet. You're lying to save yourself from the executioner. But I don't care about that, because I think you're not lying about being able to predict the comet.
He spread his hands.
I would like nothing more than to give you unending moments of my time. But as it is, I have so much work to do, and your views are so against my own philosophy that I cannot see what more there is to be gained from this suggested partnership.
That is what you're suggesting, correct?
That we work together?
The prisoner coughed.
Will you give me a chance to prove myself?
This was what John had been casting for, some desperate act to match his own desperation.
He felt himself begin to smile, but instead he hacked phlegm into a ball of wadded-up bedsheet.
Go ahead, then.
The man glanced up and out the window at the coral sky, and for a long time he seemed on the verge of weeping. Unfair, the weight of expectation, John thought, but then each one of us is given his own special dreadfulness to endure. Better perhaps to have been born as he himself had been, the seventh son of third-generation chief orbital doctors, and better perhaps to have been raised inside the faith, rather than however this man had been raised. Surely only inopportune circumstances could have led him to such a pitiful line of work.
But John felt no special sympathy for the downtrodden.
He accepted things as they came to him, and sometimes they were good, and other times they were unsatisfying. He supposed he had some persistent wish that others should do the same. After all, he'd worked all his life at something he could neither see nor touch, and there was dignity.